It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm David Asman.
I'm Janice Dean.
I'm Jimmy Failla, and this is the Fox News Rundown.
Thursday, April 18th, 2024. I'm Dave Anthony. Is NPR really considering all things? One of its editors has resigned after publicly calling out the media organization for liberal bias.
It's another product of the 60s, and it's a change from reporting to advocacy and choosing subjects and the treatments of those subjects to make points and drive an agenda as opposed to telling good stories.
I'm Jessica Rosenthal. Two Colorado counties are suing the state over sanctuary policies for migrants after officials in the state's biggest city said they welcomed in more migrants per capita than any other during this crisis.
They're going to be a more generous draw for illegal immigrants than New York, Chicago, LA. And they are already realizing that they're running out of resources. They are bankrupting the city of Denver.
And I'm Jason Rantz. I've got the final word on the Fox News Rundown.
A senior editor at NPR has gone radio silent after having a lot to say, perhaps too much. Yuri Berliner quit after 25 years at National Public Radio because of the controversy he caused with an essay he wrote in the Free Press, critical that NPR, he says, has shifted to the left with progressive or liberal bias, saying things really changed after Donald Trump won the 2016 election. And everyone at NPR was shocked and in despair. And even though he voted for Hillary Clinton,
to me, it revealed that we didn't really understand a lot of what was going on in America, that we were out of touch.
That's what Yuri Berliner told the Barry Weiss podcast, Honestly. April 9th.
We were trying to damage his presidency, to even find anything we could to harm him. And I think what we latched on to was Russia collusion.
He says they had Congressman Adam Schiff on air all the time. And what the Democrats said about the Trump campaign being tied to Russia became the drumbeat of NPR news reports.
And then the Mueller report came out and no collusion. And, you know, I think we sort of learned the story kind of disappeared.
Berliner was also critical of NPR dismissing the Hunter Biden laptop story out of the 2020 election and their biased coverage related to COVID's origins. NPR's top editor says managers there disagree strongly with Berliner and proudly stand behind their work. Before resigning, NPR suspended Berliner for failing to secure approval to do work for other news outlets.
I think it's a really sad commentary that he felt that he couldn't remain there anymore.
Howard Husick used to be a reporter at WGBH in Boston. He's now an opinion contributor to The Hill and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. From 2013 to 18, Howard was on the board of directors at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
He was disparaged by the chief executive there for writing what he did. Instead of what she should have said was, we take his remarks seriously. We're going to reflect on them as we consider our mandate to cover issues that concern all American and reach all Americans geographically and culturally. And they should have just reflected on his remarks and not disparaged him.
At the same time, what his criticism is gets right at their integrity. And people, when you criticize someone's integrity, you're going to get pushback.
I think he criticized their news judgment, and we can call that integrity.
Clearly it was taken personally by his colleagues.
It was taken personally, and they shouldn't have taken personally because he went out of his way to say, I'm loyal to NPR. I believe in NPR. I want to try to improve NPR. And these are my constructive remarks. And they should have been taken in that spirit. And true reporters, true curious, open-minded reporters would have said, maybe he has a point or maybe he doesn't, but I'm going to think it over, not I'm going to push back.
Is that, you've been in the news business a long time, Howard. Do you find that is the case, that reporters are no longer curious
in a way that it may not be what I believe, but let's explore.
Yes, there's been a change. And the change, it's another product of the 60s, and it's a change from reporting to advocacy and choosing subjects and the treatments of those subjects to make points and drive an agenda, as opposed to telling good stories. And good stories, it isn't just that you want to tell both sides because you're being fair, although that's a good thing.
It's important, but yeah.
Telling both sides makes the stories more interesting. You're in the story business, so you should be curious. You should want to have not just both sides, but as many sides as you can imagine and find.
Are you a listener now? Howard, do you listen to NPR?
It's harder for me to listen now. I do it dutifully. It's hard because you do sense an agenda, which is Uri Berliner's point. And it's a crying shame because there are 1,000 local public radio stations, 1,000. Every one of those can be an ear to the ground about what's going on in America. When the drug epidemic had yet to surface, NPR should have been the first because they have the local stations in Akron and Southern Ohio and Kentucky and West Virginia. When the subprime mortgage crisis was hitting, they should have been the first. Like Uri Berliner, I regret its decline and its failure.
You had worked, of course, as a board member for public broadcasting. So with NPR, this is not the same as other news organizations because NPR gets funding from the federal government. People who want to take that away are often met with the response of, well, it's less than 1% of NPR's budget even comes from that, and they're dismissive that that's an issue. Are they right?
No, they're not right, because here's how the system works, and you have to be an insider to understand this. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting receives a grant from the Congress. It's about $540 million a year right now, and it distributes that money. One of the ways in which it distributes is to send it to local public broadcasting stations, radio and television, all around the country through what they call community service grants. Then those stations have to pay NPR and PBS for the programs that they run.
Okay.
So the money goes out to Peoria, but then it goes back to Washington. And so that's federal money being recycled. Maybe it's not a direct grant, but it might just as well be.
Okay. So the money that NPR gets for its programming that its affiliates buy, a lot of that money comes from the federal government.
Absolutely. Each station gets at least an average about 15% of its operating budget from the federal government. And some get more. And they have to not only buy programmings, they have to pay dues. They're a network, and to be in the network, you gotta pony up.
So what do you think should happen? I mean, this debate comes up every time when public broadcasting is, you know, an issue in Congress. What do you think should be done with it? Some people think that this funding should go away, although, interestingly, Uri Berliner, in his resignation note that he sent on Wednesday, wrote, "I don't support calls to defund NPR."
I mean, the Trump administration proposed zeroing out the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. That effort failed. Republicans would not support it. A lot of Republicans like their little local public broadcasting station. They like their little talk shows that they get to appear on. So there's more resilience to the funding for public broadcasting than you might think. And so I think our best hope is to change the rules so that there's some provision that local stations have to provide local news. They can't just recycle NPR news.
Okay.
There has to be some provision that there's local content produced. And they should have to report every year to the board that I used to serve on. Who are you reaching? Are you reaching the broad cross-section of America? Are you reaching just the blue cities and the blue states and the college towns? If you're not, we're going to dock some of your money. Because the Corporation for Public Broadcasting could, it has some discretion.
Speaking of Republicans, something else Uri Berliner said on Barry Weiss's podcast got a lot of attention.
I got so frustrated with what I saw was the sort of the lack of different perspectives in our coverage that I decided to look at voter registration among our staff. I found that I looked at D.C., where it was fairly easy to access voter registration records. And what I found was 87 registered Democrats on our editorial staff, 0 Republicans.
Leading to even more questions about NPR bias.
Our challenge is to how to rewrite the rules of the Public Broadcasting Act, how to monitor it. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting Board, every year we vote up or down on the whole budget. We don't even get to vote on individual programming, individual documentaries. It's just up or down. Are you for it or against it? We need new rules to try to hold their feet to the fire. And they need much, much more accountability. Should we start from zero to getting NPR and PBS? I'd probably be skeptical about that, but it's with us, so we have to try to make it accountable.
But there's really no way for them to say, well, look, you have no registered Republicans, so unless you have some registered Republicans, we'll take away your funding. I mean, it's difficult to do that too, right?
Well, of course it's difficult, you know. I'd like to see the chief executive of NPR go up before the appropriate congressional committee and justify the fact that they have no Republicans. So there's an oversight function that the Congress doesn't play enough. What are you doing to diversify the reach of your audience? Let's have a real congressional hearing that bores in on the character of their coverage, the reason that they're funded, and whether they're serving the broad cross-section of the American public, which they are not, and that's their mandate to do.
There's been a lot in the last many years, you know, focus on DEI, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion. And obviously that's something that Uri Berliner wrote in his essay. But at the end, he wrote, the most damaging development at NPR is the absence of viewpoint diversity. Has that been lost in the whole diversity discussion?
Well, of course, that's lost at the university level, too. And diversity in the DEI context doesn't really include viewpoint diversity. Those of us who believe that viewpoint diversity is crucial to good journalism and a good education are the ones who are saying it ought to include viewpoint diversity. Where are there stories about religion? Where are there stories about local sports and how it reflects local culture? Where are there stories about coal miners and their concern about being put out of work? The emphasis is always on climate. It's always on inequality. That's their framework for seeing the country. Well, the country experiences its own self in very different ways. And open-minded journalists would be looking for good stories, drama, conflict. That's the essence of good journalism. And they should be on the lookout for it rather than just promoting their own agenda by covering stories that they think should set the political agenda.
Howard Husick, who used to work with WGBH, he was also on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Board of Directors. He's now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, opinion contributor at The Hill. Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for asking such good questions.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by the host of The Big Money Show, Brian Brenberg, to talk taxes, inflation, and the state of the American economy and what it means for 2024. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
This is Jason Rantz with your Fox News commentary coming up.
A part of the immigration debate came to an end Wednesday after both articles of impeachment against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas were voted unconstitutional in the Senate. Republicans were frustrated. After the trial adjourned, Utah Republican Senator Mike Lee expressed what the senators would have heard in a proper trial regarding allegations that Mayorkas violated immigration law.
Instead of holding them until such time as they could be removed or alternatively adjudicated to have the status, whether in the context of immigration parole or asylum or otherwise. He just released them.
The released migrants scattered throughout the U.S., but many ended up in so-called sanctuary cities by the tens of thousands. Different cities and states have dealt with the influx in various ways. Some of those ways have changed over time. In New York City, Mayor Eric Adams is cutting funding to migrants. And after higher than expected revenues came in, he said this year he'd no longer be cutting other services in the city's budget.
We should be asking the national government, why is this happening to Chicago, New York, Los Angeles, Houston?
In fact, Mayor Adams said that it's time to rethink the city's sanctuary status altogether.
If you are repeatedly committing crimes in our city, you don't have the right to be in our city and tarnish those overwhelming number who are here following the rules.
Other cities are trying to spend more on migrants. In Chicago, Mayor Brandon Johnson's request for $70 million for migrants from a surplus fund got approved and passed out of the city's budget committee. And in Denver, Mayor Mike Johnston says the city's engaged in a new asylum program with a plan to spend $90 million. That is half what they were initially planning to spend.
Which will give us a chance to better serve migrants and avoid cuts to core public services and stabilize the city budget.
They still need to find another $45 million on top of that. The plan offers migrants help for 6 months, but only for about 1,000 migrants. That's about the time when asylum seekers are able to begin work. And Johnston says the city needs more workers.
We put almost 1,500 people through work authorization in the month of March alone, a larger effort than we have seen anyplace else in the country.
While he says the budget cuts won't impact core services, it does mean an $8 million cut to the police department. Within days of the mayor's announcement, two counties to his south sued, challenging the state sanctuary laws. In an email to Fox News Radio, the governor's office said they had no comment on the lawsuit at this time.
With the influx of illegal immigrants that are being welcomed by our neighbor in Denver, which is bigger than us and self-identified as a sanctuary city, we're concerned that it's reaching a critical mass point for them.
George Teal is a Douglas County commissioner.
You know, we know that they have their own employees telling these illegal immigrants that they've welcomed into the city with open arms, you can't stay here anymore. We are running out of resources. You need to go somewhere else. Well, where could that somewhere else be? It's going to be the communities closest to Denver. Ourselves in El Paso County, do we have several communities between us and the city and county of Denver? Yes, we do. But this informal policy change where they are already talking about forcing these illegal immigrants out of the city and county of Denver, how long until we're finding these 40,000 people coming into Douglas County?
Denver officials say they've received more migrants per capita than any other big city during this migrant crisis so far. And what you're referring to is the mayor and city officials are shifting a bit now to say that they're going to limit supportive services to migrants to 6 months. That has included giving migrants a place to live, job skills training. That has been so far a big difference from Chicago and New York, where it's like you're in a shelter for like a month or two and then you're out. Also, 6 months is a long time, relatively. Are you also worried that that will serve as a draw to the area? Like, oh, if I'm only in a shelter for a month in New York, maybe I can get some help for 6 months in Denver.
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And, Denver has been very generous. But like I say, their policies are changing. We began the year with Mayor Johnston, talking about when he took office, talking about going ahead and doing a $180 million diversion in the city's budget in order to service the illegal immigrants coming in.
Wow.
He's already cut that in half to $90 million. As well as he is still cutting services throughout the government. I think there's only the DA and the clerk and recorder have avoided making budget cuts. Every other department in Denver has made budget cuts in order to find what was supposed to be $180 million And now they're realizing that they can only afford 90 million. And yeah, they're going to be a more generous draw for illegal immigrants than New York, Chicago, LA. And they are already realizing that they're running out of resources. They are bankrupting the city of Denver.
Let's talk about the lawsuit you guys have filed, you and Douglas County and El Paso County. This is in regards to two specific state statutes, and I was reading what these statutes do. Tell our listeners what the state of Colorado has in place that you guys want to stop.
Yeah, so in 2019, a law was passed that prohibits local law enforcement agencies from working with federal immigration authorities, period. Even to the point of running a name of an assailant, someone who's allegedly committed a crime and been apprehended by local law enforcement. And if this person seems to be a foreigner, seems to not be an American, for whatever factors you'd want to attribute to that, they're prohibited from even contacting immigration, contacting ICE, in order to just run the name and check. There could be an open warrant out by the federal immigration authorities against that person, and our local law enforcement are even prohibited from checking to see if there is a warrant open or not.
Yeah.
And it just goes up from there. In 20.
What's the other statute?
So House Bill 23-1100, and when it passed into law, and that one prohibits local counties from engaging in any kind of contracts with the federal government to hold and detain in county jails anyone on immigration issues. Hmm. And this is kind of a big deal. Here in the state of Colorado, you don't have municipal jails. The responsibility is given at the county level, right, under the state constitution. And so this is aimed squarely at our counties here in the state. And so it not only prevents, inhibits, as we're asserting in our lawsuit, our local law enforcement from being able to cooperate with federal officials to keep our community safe. But for that individual, for that immigrant family, you're essentially separating the family. And you are throwing a financial hardship, as well as emotional hardship, on that family that just doesn't make sense. And yet the left has persisted in drawing out this sanctuary city, sanctuary state political fad that they're only now starting to realize the real world consequences of. And so it has big impacts here in the state of Colorado. Yes, El Paso County joined us when we filed the lawsuit. We have up almost 30 other counties in the state that are planning on joining us, and they have stated it. They just didn't take the formal action like El Paso County did.
I'm sorry. You just said 30 other counties in the state are going to join you?
Actually, it's more than that. I think the last count I heard was 33.
Oh, wow. So is that almost the entire state other than Denver suing the governor?
We have 56 counties in the state of Colorado, to include the city and county of Denver. So, we're over a majority.
It's almost half the state. Yeah. So tell me, before I let you go, Commissioner, what have you heard from constituents? I know y'all have public comment at your meetings. But aside from that, also, have you received phone calls? Have people just come up to you and, you know, had conversations with you? Is there a concern about this issue that you're hearing about, or is this more preemptive?
Yeah, well, there is a great deal of concern.
I have seen political. I'm in a re-election year, so I'm sort of paying some attention to political polling. And this is the number one concern and the number one issue of concern for voters in the state of Colorado right now. I can tell you I've received nothing but encouragement, a large number of compliments from the people at Douglas County. But we've received no communications critical. That's not to say that it's going to stay that way. I'm sure we'll receive a few.
What about separate of the lawsuits, just this migrant issue? Denver's been at the heart of it for a while. You guys are so close. You're adjacent. What about the issue broadly have you heard over the, I guess, the past year or so?
Yeah, we passed an ordinance several weeks ago to deal with the dumping of a bus that would come in from Texas and be turned around by Denver. We received numerous emails complimentary, thanking us, expressing their gratitude that we are being proactive and leaning into this issue.
Douglas County Commissioner George Teal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate you helping us get the word out.
Meet the American who
made medicine safer. Deborah Adler was born September 14th, 1975 in Rockland County, New York. She attended Horace Greeley High School in Westchester County, where she was raised by a family of Holocaust refugees turned doctors who instilled in her a trailblazing spirit. After graduating from the University of Vermont, she attended the School of Visual Arts in New York City, where she studied graphic design. Here, she developed the ClearRx prescription bottle label design, which prevents the potential tragedy of someone taking the wrong medicine or dosage because of unclear labeling. Adler was inspired by her grandmother, who, after surviving 2 years in the woods hiding from German troops in World War II, nearly died from accidentally taking her husband's poorly labeled prescription. She saw this accident, along with witnessing the horrors of 9/11, as a call to action to help people, and it motivated her to work on a thesis proposal that landed her a job with renowned graphic designer Milton Glaser. Glaser, who is best known for his iconic I Love New York logo, presented Adler's prescription bottle plan to executives at Target. Her design was introduced in CVS and Target stores in 2005. Adler's most recent innovation organizes medication by specific days and times, which allows patients to follow a concise schedule. Every year, almost 9,000 Americans die from ingesting the wrong pills, and more than 7 million patients in the U.S. are impacted by medication errors. That, according to the Journal of Community Hospital Internal Medicine Perspectives. Adler's innovations are available all across the nation, showing how one person's ability to address crises with creativity and compassion can save the lives of millions. You can go to the lifestyle section of FoxNews.com to find more of these incredible American stories.
It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Subscribe to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com.
It's time for your Fox News commentary.
Jason Rantz.
What's on your mind?
Radical left activists are back at it with a tactic that feels like deja vu. These weren't your peaceful protesters rallying on Monday in solidarity with Palestinians. These are disruptors who view chaos as a stepping stone to their anti-capitalist utopia. They're just pretending to care about what happens in Gaza. It is crucial that city leaders step up now, because if they don't, we're not just looking at a repeat of past disruptions. We're staring down a potentially more vicious wave of activism that threatens our economy. From the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco to the Brooklyn Bridge in New York, activists snarled traffic, creating a hellish commute for people just trying to get home or to work. Passengers likely missed flights out of SeaTac Airport in Seattle and Chicago O'Hare International Airport thanks to activists blocking the roads in. The methods are right out of an anarchist handbook. Sleeping dragon tactics, where protesters handcuff themselves together inside PVC pipes, make it a logistical nightmare for police to intervene. Some even go as far as chaining themselves to barrels filled with concrete or using their vehicles to clog up the roads. Why are we seeing this surge of direct action? Well, they've seen it work before. The anti-police violence during the peak of the Black Lives Matter movement got them headlines and the chaos they desired. and without significant consequences, why stop? Monday's activists will get off with a slap on the wrist like a fine, or at worst, some restorative justice program they barely register as punishment. These activists aren't just random activists looking to be part of something bigger than themselves. They're diehards who see themselves as martyrs in a war not against oppression in Gaza, but against capitalism itself. Despite the banners of Free Palestine and slogans against genocide, their real battle is with the economic system that they despise. I know these people. I could write the script for how the next several weeks or months will unfold. In my new book, What's Killing America? Inside the Radical Left's Tragic Destruction of Our Cities, I detail my experiences infiltrating Antifa direct action. Monday's activism was an extension of what we saw after the death of George Floyd, only they might not waste as much time, learning from some of their mistakes in 2020 and 2021. Initially, BLM protests were largely peaceful, but then came Antifa, escalating to riots and taking over parts of Seattle and Portland. They burned buildings in Minneapolis, helped create a looter's paradise in New York. Today, some of the same figures behind those riots are blocking roads, ostensibly under the banner of Palestinian support, but really aiming to inflict economic pain as a form of protest against capitalism. Though elements of the activists are very obviously anti-Semitic, much anger is generated by Israel's embrace of capitalism. It doesn't matter that they're siding with Hamas in this war. Their hatred of capitalism is so intense, they can convince themselves there's nothing wrong with the terrorist group that subjugates women and throws gays from rooftops. Coordinated protests like those witnessed on Monday can galvanize people to join the cause. Similar to how gangs recruit vulnerable youth from broken homes, these activists target disenchanted young Americans, whether they're underemployed as baristas or disillusioned with corporate life. These individuals can become radicalized, swayed to contribute to the chaos unfolding on our streets. And we know what happens when we let it get out of hand. Unless city leaders take a firmer stance against these disruptions, expect things to escalate. We're not just dealing with a protest. It's an all-out assault on the structure of society by those who believe they have nothing to lose. If left unchecked, this movement could morph into something even more dangerous than what we witnessed with Antifa and BLM. The time for half measures is over. It's time to confront these tactics head on and restore order for everyone's sake.
You've been listening to the Fox News Rundown. And now, stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform and watch directly on outkick.com/watch.